music from Gail Salmon, her song Ordinary Places. At 10 and a half minutes after, it's a Wednesday morning on the Broken Road, and Doug Greenwald popped in. Doug, I have to fess up. I wasn't sure you were going to be here today. You know, it seemed to me we left off last week. We're talking about first century village life in Israel, and I counted on this week, but then I think, no, maybe this is the week that he's in Michigan.
Well, it's actually next week.
Okay. All right. Now we got it.
And I'll leave early tomorrow morning, but no, still in the chair for today.
Okay. Tell us about Michigan. We won't send people to find you. I know you'd like to kind of get away from it all, but where is this place
that you... Well, you know, my hometown was Grand Rapids.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
My father went to high school with Jerry Ford.
Uh-huh.
And in Michigan, sort of like in Minnesota, I suspect... What my dad was a factory worker, and the big event of the summer was when you went to college. And so we always spent a week renting a place up a little bit north of Traverse City, Michigan. It's in Antrim County.
The phrase was went to cottage?
Go to cottage.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
Really?
I had not heard that.
Yep.
Huh.
We're going up north to cottage.
Mm-hmm.
The cousin.
And so I remember the very first time that I experienced this little lake called Birch Lake, and it's because it's got birch trees all around it, sandy bottom, crystal clear water, as many lakes in Michigan do. It was 1952. I was 10 years old and absolutely fell in love with the week at the cottage.
Mm.
And we have been going back to that lake ever since. And we are going back to Birch Lake yet again next week, and at the end of that week, we'll drop down to Grand Rapids for our high school reunion.
Ah, okay.
Which, get this,
mm-hmm.
I went to Lee High School, L-E-E, and we were the Lee Rebels.
Ah.
With what's going on today in our culture, I may walk into the room there and find out that there's a meeting to declassify the school mascot or some such thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But no, as of this moment in time, I was a Lee Rebel.
So far, so good.
And yeah. It was named after Robert E. Lee, actually. It was on Lee Street. Now, Lee Street could have been named for Robert E. Lee. I never researched that.
Yeah.
But that's how innocent things were back then, and how history can be rewritten and revisionism, and suddenly what seemed fun and benign back then is, you know, moves into, for some anyway, a whole off-putting mode. Mm. And the changing winds of culture.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. that's true. And we're learning about culture. Doug is the Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, also the Executive Director there. It's a ministry based in Columbia, Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C. And Doug, I don't know anybody else. There are others that specialize in teaching biblical context. Can you name one for me? I mean, you've been with us now for 4 years on the air. We've got a wonderful library of podcasts of your teachings, but I've not heard anyone else address this information in the same way.
Well, I don't know how to answer that question. Some of the people who inspired me in the very beginning, one of them is still alive, Kenneth Bailey.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is probably the world's expert in biblical culture. Mm-hmm. There are some other fairly well-known names, but they tend to specialize in aspects of biblical culture. There are a lot of people out there, I won't name names, but they're Hebraic specialists.
Mm-hmm.
They really love to research the Hebrew word meanings, particularly as they present themselves in the Gospels, and tie them back, you know, from a Remez perspective back to the Old Testament. And as we've discussed before, linguistic matters, of course, as a context. But the linguistic, the meaning of the word, the verb, the adjective, is one of about 15 categories of context. And that's the challenge, to be sensitive to all 15 categories when it comes to a passage, to find out which of those categories are actually implicitly operative in any given passage, and then knit it back together, weave it back together to recreate the whole. So much of what constitutes contextual work in the field of biblical studies these days is some aspect of context, but you need all of the pieces to remake the puzzle, so to speak. Let me perhaps say it a different way. What we try to do at Preserving Bible Times is bake the cake. With the fully baked cake with the frosting on it comprises the total restoration of the context of a passage. There are a lot of people who will publish information and books on flour or vanilla or milk or butter, all of which are aspects or ingredients to the cake, but that's a different issue than baking the cake. And so the number of people who actually bake the cake is pretty small. It's growing. It's starting to catch on after about 15 or 20 years of our little attempt to do what we do here. And I see more and more people trying and attempting and putting more and more ingredients together. And that's really, really encouraging. But the challenge remains to recognize all of the implicit and sometimes the explicit pieces of context in a passage, in a text, and then weave that back together to recreate the original meaning of the passage always intended by the Holy Spirit. And the reason that's important is because that's where you'll find the transformational power of the passage. When we simply use a passage as a launching pad, as a trampoline to take it wherever we want to take it for our pet themes or ideas of the month or the year, that's when we start to move over into anemia, because we drift farther and farther away from the always intended transformational power of the original meaning intended by the Holy Spirit for that passage.
Well, you do a wonderful job of baking that cake, too. I've read Kenneth Bailey, and I marvel at the man's knowledge, the depth of knowledge with respect to the culture. And his Jesus Through Middle Eastern Eyes has been a big help to me. And I read that because you recommended it to me. But I see what you mean by detail. He gets so deep into, you know, prophetic matrices and things and the order of, and you've talked about some of that, but only as a part of the whole. And I think that's what makes what you have to teach so accessible to people, is they're looking for that end result, that cake.
Well, that's the challenge, and that's why it takes a lot of effort sometime and a lot of pondering and waiting for the cake to actually come out of the oven, baked, so to speak. But that's the excitement, that's the challenge, that's the thrill, that's the satisfaction of the whole process as well.
So you spoke about linguistics and language a few minutes ago. I have a question for you. What part did the Aramaic language play in the writing or the formulation of Scripture? How important is it that we also know, in addition to the Greek and the Hebrew, the Aramaic?
Well, you've just moved into a reasonably controversial area, or as...
Nope. Check your mic, Doug. There you go.
There's a bit of controversy, or maybe just we'll call it a healthy discussion. I would say, you know, for the last 50 years ago, up until 10 years ago, say from 1950 to 2000, there was a consensus that a lot of Aramaic was spoken by Jesus and the disciples, and that's the undergirding language, the linguistic of the New Testament. And then David Bibbins, out of Jerusalem, the Jerusalem school there, began to publish more and more work that would indicate, from a language, linguistic composition point of view, that a lot more Hebrew was spoken by Jesus and, by implication, the disciples than we heretofore previously thought. And so the mix is changing now to a lot more Hebrew credence that's underpinning the Gospels as opposed to Aramaic. Doesn't mean that Aramaic wasn't used and isn't there. We do see some Aramaic phrases. So that subject is, I won't say it's in flux, but it's in the process of becoming rebalanced, actually, as we speak. Just talked to a scholar yesterday who called in, who's been researching the Hebraic roots of the Gospels for the last 25 years. Again, in that Bivens school of emphasis there, that there was most likely much more Hebrew spoken than Aramaic. So to answer your question, Aramaic is important. Aramaic matters, but it might not have been quite as prominent an underpinning of the gospel record as we once thought.
Hmm. One of the details that comes to mind in this regard is the Lord's Prayer. And we've talked about that many times. And you mentioned that Jesus used the Aramaic word Abba, meaning father, as in a familial, you know, daddy kind of context. I have another Aramaic translation of the Lord's Prayer that uses the word Abwun for father, which is a legitimate Aramaic word, but it means more something more akin to father, mother, birther, creator. It transcends gender. And it's a small point of controversy, but I'd like to get it right when I talk about it to people. Was it Abba or was it Abwun? Or is there any way to tell? Is it anybody's guess?
I'm not the person to approach that question to. I'm not a linguist in that sense. And I actually get intrigued with more linguistic issues of biblical context than the linguist itself. Now you ask me, well, why would I put it that way? And that's because in the last 10 or 15 years, working in the Gospels, in lots of different passages, it seems to me, and this is an empirical assessment, that 80% of gospel passages, when you're trying to weave the original context back together to discern the original meaning, are not shaped by the linguistic issues of the words themselves. Hmm. Only 20% of the passages are. John 15:2 would be a good example where the meaning of the word Iro really does matter. But 80% of gospel passages, if you accept my rule of thumb assessment here, hinge on an aspect of village culture, or an aspect of geology, or an aspect of rainfall patterns, or an aspect of topography, or an aspect of proximity, or one of the dozen or two dozen issues that are implicit in village culture. And so I put a lot of my own emphasis in those areas, because one of the things that does exist for people who are interested in those kinds of issues is the linguistic resources are enormous. And so what I would suggest you do is you go into the New English Translation Bible, the NET Bible, N-E-T, and look at their footnotes, their linguistic footnotes for Luke 11, 1 and 2. And maybe your answer is just sitting right there.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you. I will do that.
So the one thing that does exist in plentiful abundance are linguistic resources, so that we can do our best to be sure we have the right word meaning, the right tense of the verb when we come to Pauline stuff. Are we in, which voice are we in? That's all significant. But as I said, there are resources galore for that kind of insight. It's in the other areas of biblical context that you really have to work hard to get what you're looking for.
Hmm. We were talking about village life and the village culture. Now, Jesus spent a whole lot of time, did he not, in sparsely populated areas. I say sparsely populated. I'm not. That's kind of a relative term, small, you know, not towns, not cities. He went to Jerusalem, I guess, to the festivals, but most of his time was spent in the north, wasn't it?
It was. He spent some time, an undetermined amount of time, because there's only a passing reference to it in John, in Judea, teaching in the synagogues there. That's just one sentence. But let's do the arithmetic here. His earthly ministry was, let's call it 3 years. We got 365 days to a year. Let's do the arithmetic. Let's just say that's 1,100 days. Oh, let's make it 1,000 days. He went to three major festivals once a year. So let's take 7 times 3 is 21. So I've got 21 over 365. That's what? 6%? Yeah, probably.
Okay.
So he spent 6% of his time in the big city, Jerusalem. Now, would he have gone to any of the other big cities in the north, the capitalists? The answer is no. As an observant Jewish man, he would not have. Would he ever have gone to Tiberias or Herod Antipas is? Of course not. Antipas is sworn to try to kill him. So that leaves us that 90%+ of the time, Jesus was in towns and villages because there were no big cities that were observant Jewish in nature in the Galilee district. So, yeah, I think it's really important to understand village culture because Jesus spent 93% of his time, at least on an arithmetic basis here, in that setting.
Well, now, Capernaum was a trade center, wasn't it? On the shore of Galilee, was it not a city? Was it a town? Was it a village? How big do you suppose it was?
Capernaum, when you visit Capernaum today, you're seeing about 3% of the town size at the time of Jesus excavated. Best estimates I've read is that Capernaum might have been 7,500 people.
Okay.
So, okay, you can say it's not a village. Let's call it a town. But compared to Jerusalem, compared to the size of the cities in the Decapolis, I don't think you'd call Capernaum a city.
And it was the base of his operations. How come? Was it because Peter and Andrew and James and John had the business there? What brought him to Capernaum?
Well, I'd say that's derivative. I would say, well, let's back up. Everything that Jesus did was strategic, right?
Yeah.
If he did it, he had a reason, right?
I believe
that. If he did it, yeah. He had intent. So why would he pick Capernaum? Well, two reasons. It sits up there in the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee, astride the International Highway. The International Highway is the main thoroughfare of commerce, and therefore also the main conduit of ideas and thoughts from Damascus all the way down to Egypt. Okay? So if you want to do something that would cause things to spread quickly, you want to do them in proximity to the International Highway. Secondly, Capernaum, the reason the International Highway skirts Capernaum there is the geography sort of forces it to do it that way. But when they had a low water level in the 80s, when the Sea of Galilee dropped about 20 feet, a guy named Mendel Noon, who is at Kibbutz Ein Gev, over in the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee, a lifelong resident in the kibbutz there. Actually, he's an Eastern European Jew, if I remember my history right here. Spent 50 years researching fishing around the Sea of Galilee. And when the water level dropped down 20 feet for a period of time there, several decades ago, he was able to identify the remains of 14 breakwaters that surrounded the Sea of Galilee. That tells us that in the towns, the villages, and yes, even the Decapolis cities, were sending their diverse commerce by trammel boat from those 14 ports to Capernaum to transact commerce-wise with the International Highway. That's why we find Levi there, the port tax collector in Capernaum, because that's where all the trade is entering that part of the country to intersect with the International Highway. So once again, we see the strategic nature of Capernaum. It's the consolidation of all the shipping around the Sea of Galilee comes into one place, and then it transacts with the International Highway. So I would suggest to you that's why Jesus is there. Now, let me make one other observation. If you've ever been to Capernaum, you say to yourself, what a lovely place. It's beautiful. It's relatively quiet. It's scenic. And I always chuckle at that because sometimes we think if you're in ministry, it's got to be in a hardship place like Outer Mongolia or Siberia. And Jesus had a very, very lovely place as the basis for his Galilean ministry.
And of course, his disciples, I suppose. I'm thinking again of Peter, Andrew, James, John, and Levi came from that. Most of them came from that Galilee region, didn't they?
Yes and no. Actually, Peter was probably born and raised in Bethsaida, which is, you know, if we're at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee looking north and it's a clock, it's like 12:30 or 1 o'clock. Okay?
Mm-hmm, okay.
At the time of Jesus, that quadrant was actually called Gaulonitis, and was a Hellenistic Jewish region. It had gone through a transition for about 30 or 40 years from observant Judaism to Hellenistic Judaism. And that's why we're pretty well convinced Peter, and perhaps some others, left Bethsaida to go to Capernaum because they wanted to leave the growing influence of Hellenistic Judaism and keep their roots deep into observant Judaism. So at their source, they probably were not from the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. They were probably from the northeast quadrant, but they ended up in the northwest quadrant because that's the center of observant Judaism at the time of Jesus.
Mm. Interesting. What else might have held him there? I mean, travel, it wasn't easy to pick up and go to Jerusalem. That was, what, a two-day walk, three-day walk?
Oh, no. On the shortest route, it was a minimum five, probably six days for most people, which is highly important. There's an old saw out there that goes like this. No upright observant Jew would ever walk through Samaria to go to festival in Jerusalem from the Galilee. What he would do is he'd cross over to the other side of the Jordan River Valley to the district of Perea and then go all the way south down.
Nope, you hit your button again, down to Jericho. Nope, 1 second here, we'll get him back.
If you did it that way, it takes at least 7 days to make that journey by foot, because you travel 16 to 18 miles a day by foot, okay? Mm-hmm. And we're talking like a 95-mile journey here. But in having to go east before you start to go south, and then when you get to the end of your southern journey to then go west another day, up 4,000 feet, up the Wadi Kilt to get to Jerusalem, you can't make that walk between Shabbats.
Between Sabbath, and yes, because you're limited in how many steps you can take on the
Absolutely.
Sabbath.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. And so it's just, it doesn't hold water. Most people, to fit this journey in within a six-day window of time, would come right down the Central Ridge route. They'd come right down the hill country of Samaria and then into the hill country of Judea until they got to Jerusalem. So, you know, that's an old wives' tale. It just doesn't hold scrutiny once we look at the distances and the options for travel and then plot it out in terms of how long it would take. It's yet another reason why geography matters.
So you're saying that the tendency would have been to bypass, to walk around Samaria. That would have been the main route. I mean, were they violently opposed to traffic through Samaria, the Samaritans?
No. I must have misspoken.
Okay,
here. It's worse to have to walk through the Decapolis than it is to walk through Samaria.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you look at a map, to avoid Samaria, you have to take a dog leg to in one direction, and then you got to go all the way down and take your dog leg back the other direction. You actually are adding a day to a day and a half of travel to your journey.
Okay, so they did actually go the more direct route through Samaria. That was
absolutely
the more common. Okay.
Yep.
Gotcha.
And just for historical interest here, this would have always been done by caravan. And the men and the young men, 13 or over, would have been in one caravan, and all the women and the younger children would have been in another caravan. And the caravans would have been at least 1 hour apart on the road, because the rabbis have said you can't co-mingle.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And that's how you travel. No Greyhound buses, no Amtrak trains, no stagecoaches.
Mm-hmm. Were there horses?
The only people who had horses would be the Roman legion, and probably the elites, perhaps in Jerusalem. But no, a horse is expensive, B is big, and C requires grass to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever walked that land and seen how hilly and rocky it is and understand the rainfall patterns, you know, for a large portion of the country here, you can't afford to invest in growing grass for grazing. If you do have good enough soil and adequate enough rainfall, you're going to grow grain on that flat land, not grazing for grass.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may have had donkeys, but even then, that would be considered a luxury. You walk.
Okay. Well, what else about village life do we need to delve into here today?
Well, last week we covered two issues, basically, that are part of village life and therefore an implicit part of just about every passage or teaching or encounter that Jesus does, says, or records for us on the pages of the Gospels, mandatory hospitality and social reciprocity. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit of how that works itself out. Another issue that's at work on the pages of the Gospels and every passage, every just about every encounter, just about every teaching, is the issue of honor and shame. It is so predominant, it is so much permeates the gospel record that it's never written, it's never recorded, it's never mentioned. And that's one of the fascinating things about context, is you have to realize what is so common, what is so pervasive, what is so well understood that it's never mentioned when we read the passages with our Western eyes, but we have to project it back into the passage. So this issue of honor and shame, which we're familiar with in the Middle East, in the Near East in particular, and it still shows up today. I mean, it was about every 6 months, there's another newspaper article from Pakistan. I just read one, interestingly enough, from India here within the last month, where there was an honor killing, where supposedly a young woman did something sexually to dishonor the family, and so the brothers killed her. This notion of honor and shame is still around. It's still firmly entrenched in many Eastern cultures. And it was firmly entrenched in the first century as well. You don't ever want to do anything to shame your family, your clan, or your village. And you noticed how I phrased that. It isn't an issue of shaming yourself, because the community is always more important than the individual. All your decisions, all your behaviors are predicated on the fact, will this bring honor to my clan, honor to my family, honor to my village? And these issues of honor and shame stick around for an awfully long time. So for example, in John 2, when we have the wedding at Cana, if indeed they would have run out of wine, do you realize what that means to the host family of that wedding feast?
A huge embarrassment.
No, forget the word embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Profound shame. The village would never, ever forget that from generation to generation. And every child born of that family from generation to generation would carry the stigma of that shame. Okay? No one would ever want to marry that family. And if you were the maitre d' of that particular wedding event, you would never get another marriage gig for the rest of your life. You are shamed as the maitre d' for having mismanaged the resources of that particular wedding feast. And think of this young couple. They're full of joy at the moment. They're celebrating in the main courtyard of a multi-room home. And they're completely oblivious to the fact that they're reputation is hanging in by a thread here for the rest of their life. See? And Jesus rescues that family, that young couple, from shame by the miracle of converting the purification water in those purification water jars into wine. The motif of honor and shame, particularly one of shame, is just all throughout that Cana wedding passage in Luke 2, and yet the word shame is never there in the text.
Okay? And as a set of Western eyes, a Western-trained mind, that never would have come to mind in reading that story.
Absolutely. And when we get to the prodigal son, the younger son shames his father by his request, shames his family by that request, and within an hour, since there are no secrets in a Near Eastern village, okay, he has shamed the village by his request. Father, I wish you were dead, which is implicitly what he's saying when he says, give me my inheritance. Once again, the issue of honor and shame permeates that story, and yet the word honor and shame is never mentioned in the text. And so that's why when the prodigal son returns toward the end of that parable, the father has to invite the village elders to the wedding to the feast, where they're going to partake of the fatted calf, because he has to re-up the honor. He has to provide esteem to the village elders who have been shamed by the conduct of his younger son.
Mm-hmm. And you've talked about honor shame being kind of a zero-sum deal. In other words, if you've been slighted by someone, you need to return the disfavor, I suppose. It's like a mathematical thing, an arithmetic thing, the number of insults, isn't it, and degree.
Well, I would paint the picture of a teeter-totter.
Yeah.
For one person's esteem to go up, somebody's esteem has to go down.
Hmm.
For one person's honor to be restored, somebody's honor has to go down. And that, in a nutshell, this zero-sum game of honor and shame, is at the core of why peace in the Middle East will be so difficult to achieve. It's a zero-sum game. And so if you're a Palestinian family or clan, and in 1948 or 1949 or 1950, the Israelis took away your 20-acre olive orchard, okay, you've just been shamed. And how can you restore your honor? You have to get it back. It's a zero-sum game. And one of the reasons why the gospel message is so powerful, or can be so powerful in this Middle Eastern setting here, is it breaks this paradigm of zero-sum honor and shame issue, okay? We can both be, I'm going to use our vernacular with it, we can both approach this from a win-win situation, which is currently outside their paradigm.
Is this turn the other cheek?
Now, it does, but it more recognizes grace. It more realizes mercy. Okay,
which was in short supply back then.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing. Yeah. I think we're going to run out of time to develop it here. But in 2 weeks, when I get back from our little sabbatical up in northern Michigan, let's pick up another piece of village life here. It's encapsulated in the phrase, mercy is missing. Hmm. And the implications of that for the passages we read, and when we develop that just a little bit, the fact that mercy is missing in observant Judaism, which is the predominant religion, if you will, of these villages in the Galilee district, we'll start to understand why Jesus had to give the Good Samaritan parable.
Hmm. Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Doug, you have a terrific time. Be safe over there in Michigan and just enjoy the beauty of it all. We're talking to Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. You can visit their website easily with a click on ours. There's a link for preservingbibletimes.org right there, and discover just a wealth of resources that they have to offer there. So we urge you to do that. Doug, thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay, guys. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, shalom. Shalom, shalom, Doug.